Right now, someone knows something you should know, and someone is doing something that you should do. Now, once you believe this, you will begin asking others, who do you know that I should know? Don't settle for who you already know or what you already know. Don't be like Yogi Berra, who said, I'm in favor of leaving the status quo as it is. People you haven't yet met, but can meet, will help you get on the other side of yes. Taking action. Action creates opportunities. The best opportunity is seldom behind the first door that you come to. But going through that first door will be essential till you get to other doors that presents the better opportunities. As Dr. Jonas Salk said, the greatest reward for doing is the opportunity to do more. Opportunities are like rabbits. You get a couple and learn to handle them, and pretty soon you have a dozen. An opportunity grasp and use produces another opportunity. The more successful you are, the more opportunities that will be given to you. Prepare for opportunities. In addition to looking for opportunities, you also need to prepare for them. One of my all-time favorite quotes is by legendary UCLA basketball coach John Wooden, who said, "When opportunity comes, it's too late to prepare." These words have inspired me to keep working and growing because I never know when the door of opportunity is going to open wide. But I know that those who become successful are ready when it does. To be prepared for opportunity, you must produce results and make sure that you are the most qualified when the door opens. Are you working as hard as you can? Are you learning as much as you can? Are you connecting with others as often as you can? Are you building a team as well as you can? All these things make you ready and put you closer to the door when it opens. Do you hear that? That's the sound of your door opening. Will you be ready? Activate your current opportunities. It's always easier to see opportunities we've missed, the ones that are behind us, than to see the ones in front of us now. To live on the other side of yes, we need to be like my friend Larry Stockso. We need to focus on the current moment and activate whatever opportunity is presenting itself. We need to open the door before us, not lament the door behind us that we missed. As Mother Teresa said, yesterday is gone. Tomorrow has not yet come. We only have today. Let us begin. If we activate the opportunities we have now and keep pursuing them, we will eventually cultivate success momentum. To do that, we must stay hungry, believe we will have opportunities, seize the small ones when we find them, and build upon them until we are ready for even bigger challenges. Robert Lynch, president and CEO of America for the Arts, said, "Creativity is the most effective response to rapid change." Why? Because creativity always adds. Leader shifting from maintaining to creating allows you to lead people into the land of abundance and opportunity. And that's especially important if you are operating in an environment that does not value or cultivate creativity, as I was early in my career. In his book, The Creative Priority, Jerry Hirschberg wrote, "No one in a corporation deliberately sets out to stifle creative thought. Yet, a traditional bureaucratic structure with its need for predictability, linear logic, conformance to accepted norms, and the dictates of the most recent long-range vision statement is a nearly perfect idea-killing machine. People in groups regress toward the security of the familiar and the well-regulated. Even creative people do it. It's easier. It avoids the ambiguity, the fear of unpredictability, the threat of the unfamiliar, and the messiness of intuition and human emotion. If you desire to be successful and to be the best leader you can possibly be, you cannot settle for the familiar. You cannot live in your comfort zone. You need to be willing to be uncomfortable. You need to embrace the words of American Giant, the manufacturer of what they call the greatest sweatshirt ever made. In an ad highlighting their own willingness to be uncomfortable in order to achieve excellence, they say, "Comfortable isn't comfortable. Comfortable never got up before dawn. Comfortable won't get its hands dirty. Comfortable has nothing to prove. Comfortable can't get the job done. Comfortable doesn't have new ideas. Comfortable won't dive in head first. Comfortable isn't the American dream. Comfortable has no guts. Comfortable never dares to be great. Comfortable falls apart at the seams. Don't get comfortable. Don't ever get comfortable. Make the shift to abundance. Get out on the edge. Break new ground. Seize opportunity. Get creative. As I think about the chapter that we just read, it just really reminds me again that when I made this leadership from maintaining to creating, it was a dynamic emotional shift. Because I left my security. I left what I had done well. I left what I knew well. And I decided to cross that chasm into a life that would begin to create. I talked in the chapter about my outer circle. They're the ones that are seasonal. They aren't directly connected to my work, but they're directly connected to me. They allow me to be who I am. They kind of address and welcome my strengths, and they allow me to kind of sometimes break the rules. They have nothing at stake except personal friendship. I can still remember when I started my outer circle, Linda Eggers, and I had a conversation about it. And I could tell that she was uncomfortable. Now, Linda has been with me for 31 years. She is an incredible, gifted, talented, committed, loyal person. She's a fabulous assistant. She literally runs my entire life. Everything, finances, schedule, all the things that I need to do, Linda's in the middle making it happen. And I can remember Linda talking to me about the outer circle. And she looked at me and very sincerely just asked me, "John, why do you have an outer circle? Am I not enough?" What a question. Somebody that's been with me for 31 years asking, "Am I not enough?" I know I surprised her with my answer, but when I explained it, she was comforted by it. I said, "No, Linda, you're not enough." But before she could maybe take that answer very personal, I looked at her and said, "Let me say something. I'm not enough either. None of us on the inner circle is enough. We need other people that always can think differently and make us better." That day, Linda understood that no matter how good, loyal, faithful, gifted, no matter all these great traits that you have in your life, it's never enough. There's always someone else that can come alongside of you, and they can help you and add value to you and take you to a level that perhaps you haven't been before. Many people in this outer circle, they're here just for a season, and then they're gone. But wow, am I grateful for them, because they allow me to be creative. My inner circle, they're in today, they're doing the work, they're faithful, they're loyal. They're the ones that make me day in, day out. That outer circle, they allow me to have a breath of fresh air. So the question I have for you is very simple. Do you have an outer circle? Do you have someone who doesn't have any kind of maybe stake in the game or skin in the game, and yet in the same sense, they're wise and they love you and they care for you, and every once in a while you just need to go to them and ask some advice or get a little counsel, get a little direction from them? I just want you to know that if you're going to leave the land of maintaining and go to the land of creating, it's going to be because you go beyond yourself. You even go beyond those who are closest to you. And you go seek out experiences, places, people, that you can find a way to breathe again, to breathe more deeply, and to let the breath of creativity make you who you are destined and called to become. Trust me on this. You're better than you think, but you'll never know that until you leave the maintaining zone of your life and go into that creating shift. It's the shift that helps you realize your potential. Chapter 7, Ladder Climbing to Ladder Building, The Reproduction Shift. Isaac Newton said, "If I have seen farther than others, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants." I've always been a talker from the time I was a child through high school, in college, and into my career as a pastor. That trait, coupled with a desire to improve as a communicator and a degree of success in leadership, landed me some big opportunities to speak at a relatively young age. Sometimes I got to speak before large crowds alongside some amazing speakers. When I started getting these great opportunities for speaking gigs, my excitement was always mixed with fear. My eagerness to get out and speak was often tempered by worry because of my lack of experience. I was glad for the exposure and the chance to teach new audiences, but I was also aware that I was over my head. Early in my speaking career, at most events, I was at the bottom of the class. I told you about one of those experiences in Los Angeles where I learned to embrace fear and speak anyway. But I also started to do something else. Whenever I got invited to speak, I became the chief cheerleader of all the other speakers. I sat in the front row. I laughed at their stories. I wrote down all of their insights. I stood and cheered as they walked off stage. And I stood in line to thank them for helping me after the event. The speakers were very accepting of me, even though most of them were old enough to be my father. I was invited into the green room with the other speakers, and I often found myself mixing with them, asking questions and getting feedback on what they were learning. They embraced me as one of their own and took me under their wing. I was grateful to be with them and to learn from them on the speaker circuit, and I felt like I was headed for the top. After the thrill of being part of such wonderful speaking teams started to wear off, I began to analyze my communication and my impact on my audiences. Here's what I discovered. After I was done speaking, there was lots of inspiration, but not a lot of application. People who heard me speak were glad they came, but they weren't sure what to do with anything I said when they got home. I was encouraging everybody, but I wasn't helping anybody. Time to make a change. It took me a while to figure out my problem, but after asking experienced communicators questions and listening to their responses, I realized what was wrong. My focus was totally on myself. The experience was more about me than the people I was there to help. My subject matter, my stories, my points, my thoughts, my delivery, it was all about me. After I spoke, the questions I was asking myself afterward were, how did I do? Did they like me? Did they like what I said? Did they clap for me? Were they impressed by my talent? Do they admire me? When I realized what I had been doing, I felt exposed and saw the error of my ways, and I knew that I had to make a shift. My speaking had to change, and so did my attitude. It was wrong for me to try to gain fans. Instead, I needed to make friends. I needed to focus on others and on adding value to them when I spoke. I took some time to reflect. I wondered how I could make the changes needed in this area. So I wrote something to help me. This is what I wrote. It's not about me, it's about them. Success is not a standing ovation, it's people walking out with a game plan. My talk is not to help me look good, it's to help them get good. If they can't relate to what I want to say, I shouldn't say it. If they can't apply what I say to their lives, I shouldn't say it. When I'm done, don't expect them to give me a hand. Invite them to come shake my hand. When they walk away, hope that they say, "His name is John, and he's my friend." Eventually, this shift started to bleed into my leadership, where it wasn't even supposed to be about me. Leadership should always be about others. Before this, I was a ladder climber. Nearly everything I did was motivated by the question, how high can I go? But making this shift helped me to realize that there was more to life than getting to the top. Instead of just trying to be successful personally, I could help others. And over the years, I realized that there were a series of shifts I could make, and they came in stages. First was ladder climbing, how high can I go? Then ladder holding, how high will others go with a little help? Then I went to ladder extending, how high will others go with a lot of help? To the final important stage, ladder building. Can I help them build their own ladder? This leader shift is about changing from being a personal producer to an equipper of others. It's a shift that takes your leadership math from addition to multiplication. It takes you from the solitary climb to the top of your ladder, where you might enjoy the view and wave to the people down below, to watching many people climb to the top of their own ladders, and you all enjoy the view from the top together. Ladder stages. I want to explain the four stages I went through to help you make this shift in your leadership. Number one, ladder climbing. How high can I go? Wanting to climb the ladder yourself isn't a bad thing, because credibility in leadership is often built on personal success. No one wants to follow a leader who cannot succeed. People want to be on a team only if they know they have a chance to win. So the first step in leadership is not leading others, it's leading yourself. It's showing you are capable of climbing the ladder yourself. Speaker Glenn Turner once told me, "The hardest challenge of getting to the top of the ladder was getting through the crowd at the bottom. Being able to climb the ladder yourself is the first step in separating yourself from the rest of the crowd." In separating yourself from the rest of the crowd. If you need help in figuring out how to do that, ask yourself these three questions. First, what are my strengths? Success comes from building upon your strengths and making the most of them, not from bringing your weaknesses up to par. For example, three of my top strengths are strategy, activation, and woo. That's from Strength Finders. Where am I weak? I don't do well with tasks related to administration or maintenance. And I'm absolutely terrible when it comes to anything technical. Any time or energy spent in these areas would be a total waste. Know what your strengths are and start developing them. Second, what are my opportunities? I believe everyone has opportunities. I do, and I'm convinced that you do. The opportunities you receive may not be as big as you want. They may not be the kind that you want, but they are opportunities. What should you do with them? Apply your strengths to them and make the most of them. The meeting of your strengths with an opportunity is where you get a chance to start climbing the ladder. Make the most of it. Even if it's not the perfect opportunity, and trust me, it won't be, because there's really no such thing, you can start the climb. Once you climb up out of the crowd, you'll discover other, better opportunities. Third, am I taking steps every day? When you seize an opportunity and apply your strengths to it, you still have to do the work. If you can't answer yes to the question of whether you're taking steps every day, you won't succeed, and you'll have to forget about taking the next step toward becoming a ladder builder. How high do you need to climb? My answer is that you need to get to the top 10%. That's the magic number. That's where you become set apart from all the rest of the areas of money, influence, opportunity, and relationships. That's where the quality of people who want to be on your team changes drastically. So as you work to climb the ladder yourself, one of the things you need to ask yourself is whether you can get to that top 10%. If you can, then you will be able to start holding the ladder for others. As you climb the ladder of success, here's some advice for making sure you're doing it as effectively as possible. Make sure your ladder is on a firm foundation of integrity and strong character. Make sure your ladder is leaning against the right building for your purpose. Never step on other people while climbing up. Don't skip any rungs of the ladder. Step back down occasionally to rest, reflect, and gain perspective. Don't step on anyone while descending either. Each time you start to climb back up, make sure you improve. Always value the people who are holding the ladder for you. The better you are at climbing the ladder yourself, the more you will have to give others when you move on to the next phases. Number two, ladder holding. How high will others go with a little help? My friend Kevin Myers, the leader of 12 Stone Church, said leaders should want more for their people than from their people. I talked a little about that in chapter one on shifting from a soloist to a conductor. When you want more for others, you're willing to give them some help. It's like holding the ladder for another person, giving them a secure base, empowering them to make moderate risks, and allowing them to climb higher. I've benefited from many people who are willing to hold the ladder for me as I climbed, especially when I was younger. Their initial support was key to my success. They made me better, and their help inspired me to want to help others. If you've been successful, you're ready to begin helping others by holding the ladder for them. Here are the things you need to know to get started. Ladder holding begins with a serving attitude. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Our chief want in life is somebody who shall make us do what we can." Adopting a serving attitude so that we will hold the ladder for others helps us to do what we can. Plus, living out an attitude of service sets a good example to the team and is a visual reminder of the importance of servanthood. When you show the people you work with that you are willing and able to serve, then they will be willing and able to serve also. Ladder holding requires availability. To become a ladder holder, you must be open to people and willing to give of yourself. When someone asks a question, you must be willing to answer. If you're asked an opinion, you need to be willing to talk. When people want your ideas, you need to jump in. If they want your endorsement, give it. Ladder holding is simply one leader helping another leader. When you engage with young leaders, value them, believe in them, encourage them, and give resources to them. Make yourself available to them. Ladder holding attracts people who want to climb. The greatest way to raise up good leaders is to recruit people with good leadership potential. How do you attract those kind of individuals? Develop a reputation for investing in others. Young, talented people who desire to achieve will begin seeking you out if you can become known for giving others a leg up. Ladder holding is a pre-qualifier for discovering a person's potential. How do you gauge others' ability to grow? How do you determine whether they can become good or even great leaders? By watching how they perform when given opportunities. By holding the ladder and offering them the chance to climb, you find out whether they take the steps they can and how quickly and easily they perform. You get a sense of their ability and desire, and that gives you insight into their eventual potential. Ladder holding over time multiplies effectiveness. Business magnate and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie said, "It marks a big step in your development when you come to realize that other people can help you do a better job than you could do alone. I've discovered that helping others helps me. Over the years, being a ladder holder has given me a huge return on my investment." My friend Chris Hodges says, "A dream is a compelling vision you see in your heart that is too big to accomplish without the help of others. When you start holding the ladder for others, you enlist their help. To take them to an even higher level, you need to do more." Number three, ladder extending. How high will others go with a lot of help? The next step in the process is to extend the ladder for others. When you do that, you empower them to climb higher and go to an entirely new level. How do you do that? By intentionally and strategically mentoring them. Over the years, I've sought out a lot of mentors who have extended the ladder for me. I've also been a mentor to many leaders, so I know this territory pretty well. Whether you're in the stage of your leadership to be extending the ladder to others or you're looking for someone to help you develop, here are the criteria for being a good mentor. Ladder extenders are successful. Who you learn from is as important as what you learn. Good mentors are successful. Since the word mentor is both a verb, something you do, and a noun, something you are, a good mentor must exhibit ability in both areas. In the area of doing, this means they are productive. When it comes to being, good mentors possess strong character. If both components aren't there, don't consider asking them to mentor you. Ladder extenders are specialists. A mentor ought to be very skilled in just a few areas. Often people seek out a mentor to help them in all areas of their life. That's not realistic. No one can help you with everything. Instead of looking for one mentor, seek out several for each key area in your life that you're working on. For example, I have sought different mentors for the following areas: relationships, equipping, attitude, leadership, communication, health, and faith. You'll notice that the first four are the areas I identified as essential for success when I leadershifted from goals to growth. Communication is my greatest strength, so I'm continually trying to build upon that. The last two, health and faith, are areas that I consider essential to who I am as a person. I think it's obvious that one person would not be able to help me with all seven of those areas. That said, when you're first starting out and learning the basics, one solid leader may be sufficient to help you. As you advance, become more specialized in your growth. Your mentors will need to be more specialized. Ladder extenders are mature. The whole idea of working with a mentor implies that the person is ahead of you. He or she is bigger, faster, more knowledgeable, and more experienced. It means the person possesses maturity. Here's how I would describe that. The ability to make decisions based on the big picture, not just the immediate one. The capacity to face unpleasantness, frustration, discomfort, and defeat without complaint or collapse. The choice to live up to responsibility and do the right thing, not the convenient thing. The willingness to stick with a task, project, or situation until it comes to completion. The discipline to harness abilities and energies to do more than is expected. The ability to take in difficult information and keep things confidential. The openness to share personal difficulties when appropriate and helpful. The compassion to connect with others without trying to correct them. Why is maturity essential in a mentor's life? Because we teach what we know, but we reproduce who we are. Ladder extenders are practiced in the art of asking questions. Good mentors don't jump to conclusions. They ask questions and explore ideas to unlock doors that would otherwise remain locked. I emphasize this because I have not always been good at asking questions. I used to be very quick with answers and had to slow down to become a better listener. Today, when I work with somebody, I try to follow this process. Ask questions. In a mentoring situation, the first questions I ask are often preset and focus on basic information. They are designed to learn about the person's background, history, strengths, and aspirations. Listen. I work hard to be fully engaged, not only because listening used to be a weakness of mine, but because the answers I receive enable me to ask a second set of questions. Listening to the answers for the first set of questions expands my understanding and connects me with the person. Ask follow-up questions. At this stage, I have the information I need to ask better questions. This is when I discern how to really help the other person. I equate this process to making halftime adjustments, the way a coach does during a ball game. If the answers to the first set of questions represent the pregame plan, then the answers to the second set of questions are like halftime. Allow me to make some adjustments. Learn. The second set of questions deepens my understanding and allows me to create a specific individual game plan for the person to take them from where they are to where I believe they could be. And then lead. I'm now ready to challenge, encourage, and coach them to their potential. A lot of leaders are too quick to give direction when what they need to do is ask questions. If you're in a place to start extending the ladder for others, develop the ability to ask questions and carefully listen. And if you are working with a mentor and the person isn't asking you any questions, be aware that he or she may not be able to take you very far in the process. Ladder extenders are humble. The mentoring relationship is at its best when both people meet and interact on common ground. This is especially important since the mentor is usually working from the position of greater strength, position, and experience. How is this common ground maintained? Through the humility of the mentor. If he or she maintains an openness to sharing failures, disappointments, and losses, the person being mentored benefits tremendously. When I was younger and began mentoring others, I naturally wanted to share my successes. As I got older, I realized that we may impress people with tales of our successes, but we impact them when we share our failures. The more successful the mentor, the more important it is to share weaknesses as well as strengths. Nobody has all good days and nobody has all bad days. Life for everyone is a daily mix of highs and lows, pleasure and pain, gains and losses, ups and downs. Humility and the authenticity from both the ladder extender and the emerging leader create a strong foundation where growth is possible. Now let's talk about number 4, ladder building. Can I help them build their own ladder? Once you've climbed the ladder of success yourself, begun to hold it for others, and then learned how to extend it for emerging leaders by mentoring them, there is still another level you can go to as a developer of people. You can become a ladder builder. One of the best ladder building leaders I know is Sam Chan. He has written several books that contain the word ladder in the title. Who's Holding Your Ladder? What's Shaking Your Ladder? And Who Moved Your Ladder? Sam's license plate is literally LDDRMAN, Ladder Man. And he was my inspiration for the title of this chapter. Ladder building is all about giving another leader the permission, equipping, and empowerment to create their own ladder. As a leader, if you surround yourself with excellent people with high potential, there will be a time when you should allow them to build their own ladders. That's the time when you release them to lead on their own. It is my joy in this season of life to focus on ladder building. For the last 20 years, my nonprofit organizations, EQUIP and the John Maxwell Leadership Foundation, have trained leaders around the world so that they are equipped to build their own ladders. And for almost a decade, we have been able to give thousands of coaches around the world a platform through the John Maxwell team. The training and support they receive empowers them to build their own ladders by starting or improving their careers as coaches, trainers, and speakers. And the best thing about it is that ladder building has no limitations imposed. People can build and climb as high as their talent and work ethic will take them. I have to say, I find it very rewarding to kick leaders out of the nest and watch them succeed. To lay groundwork for becoming a ladder builder, start by asking yourself some questions. Do I develop leaders to benefit others or just for the benefit of myself and my team? Do I relinquish control and give other leaders the freedom to be themselves and develop their own process? Am I happy for a leader that I help to move on without me or to enlist other mentors? Am I willing to help other leaders build their own ladders and then genuinely root for them? Am I willing to keep helping other leaders build their own ladders without expecting to receive any credit? If you can answer yes to those questions, then you've climbed up to the ladder enough for yourself to have earned credibility, and you now are ready to start your journey to become a ladder builder. Start helping others and mentoring them, and when you see an opportunity to encourage others to build their own ladders, don't hesitate to give them a hand. Questions to ask about the person you mentor. Andy Stanley often says, do for one what you wish you could do for many. That's great advice. And when it comes to investing in and helping someone by holding, extending, and building his or her ladder, it's important who you choose as the one. Your time is limited, and if you can spend time with only one person, it has to be the right one. With that in mind, ask the following questions about anyone that you are considering helping. Question number one, is this person hungry to learn? Author Napoleon Hill said, strong, deeply rooted desire is the starting point of all achievement. Much of what people accomplish in their lives is based more on how much they want it than on how easy it was to get. Hope says, there must be a way, while hunger says, I will make a way. People with hope are many, people with hunger are few. I want to mentor one of the few. If you have to talk the person into being helped or convince him or her to follow through on your advice, that may not be someone you should be investing in. As poet Rudyard Kipling said, if you don't get what you want, it's either a sign that you did not seriously want it or that you tried to bargain over the price. Question number two, what is this person's capacity? Hunger is easy to evaluate. Capacity? Now that's much more difficult. When I'm considering whether to mentor someone, I use the seven capacities that I wrote about in my book, No Limits, to evaluate him or her. Let me give them to you. One is energy capacity, their ability to push on physically. Two, emotional capacity, their ability to manage emotions. Three, thinking capacity, their ability to think effectively. Four, people capacity, their ability to build relationships. Five, creative capacity, their ability to see options and find answers. Six, production capacity, their ability to accomplish results. And seven, leadership capacity, their ability to lift and lead others. I want anyone I mentor to show plenty of potential to grow in all seven areas. As David Salyers of Chick-fil-A said, the mentor pours into the student, knowing that as that person grows, the return will be greater than the investment. People cannot show a great return if they don't have adequate capacity. Question number three, are this person's values compatible with mine? Shared values gives you a track to run on with someone you intend to mentor. They provide a very important common ground and philosophical foundation. When I prepare to mentor people, I want to know that they add value to people. They must be givers who want to help others as I do. Value personal growth. They must demonstrate a lifestyle of learning. Lead by example. They understand that follow me are the best words a leader can say to a follower. Exceed expectations. They stand out and receive 80% of life's return on investment. And they live intentionally. They know that everything worthwhile is uphill, and they climb intentionally every day. Only if we share these common values will I invest in them. Do you know what your values are? Identify them clearly so that you know whether or not you should invest in a potential candidate. Question number four. Is this individual a leader? Because my particular calling is to add value to leaders who multiply value to others, I will not invest in a person who is not a leader. I know that may sound very narrow, but it's focused and strategic. I discovered when I mentor a leader, the ROI is much greater than if I pour myself into a follower. With a leader, I truly can do for one what I wish I could do for many, because that leader will influence many. With followers, that's not necessarily true. What do leaders need from a mentor? I like what Tim Elmore, the founder and president of Growing Leaders, says about this. Tim is one of the emerging leaders I helped more than 30 years ago. First, I helped hold his ladder, then extend it. And more than 20 years ago, I helped him build his own ladder and cheered him on. He speaks extensively on mentoring and has written about it also. Some of the things, Tim says, a successful mentor gives to the person being mentored are handles, laboratories, roadmaps, routes, and wings. Let me explain. Handles. Good mentors distill truths from complexity and divide the information into bite-sized principles that others can apply. All good mentors can put life lessons into a nutshell that is transferable. Are you willing to do the homework necessary to do that? Laboratories. Good mentors provide a safe place where learners can practice the principles they're learning. Are you willing to create such a safe environment where people you're developing can take risk? Roadmaps. Good mentors give leaders direction for life and provide roadmaps for the options for how to proceed to their destination. Are you willing to follow through with a good game plan for the people you mentor? Roots. Good mentors provide learners with a solid relational foundation. Giving stability and security makes it possible for others to grow and flourish. Are you willing to extend love and acceptance to the people you mentor and hang in there with them when they face difficulties? Wings. Good mentors help people to see new horizons and fly to places beyond where they imagined that they could go. This is true empowerment. Are you willing to celebrate when people you mentor fly higher or farther than you have? Wise. I want to add one more quality to Tim's list. One of the most important things you can do for potential leaders is to help them to see the big picture by teaching them the whys. This gives them context. It reveals to them the thinking and the reasons behind your decisions. It teaches them decision making. If you want learners to follow directions, you only need to provide the what. But if you want them to lead others and give directions, you must also have the why. Are you willing to take the time and trouble to give them the why behind every what? I've already mentioned that one of my mentors was Fred Smith. He was a model to me in the leadership from climbing to building ladders. By the time I met him, he had already made that transition. Early in my relationship with him, I watched as every month for 3 years, he met with a group of 20 young CEOs, and he poured himself into them. When he sensed that it was time for them to move ahead without him, he ended his ladder extending time with them and encouraged them to build ladders on their own. A year after he formally disbanded the group, those leaders asked to meet with Fred one evening. One by one over dinner, the CEO shared with Fred all that he had done for them, how he had helped them become better leaders. At the close of the meeting, they presented him with a beautiful piece of Bacharach crystal with the following words etched in it. He stretched us. That's what all leaders do who shift from ladder climber to ladder builder. They help new leaders stretch to their potential. That's what I hope to do for the rest of my life and to leave as my legacy. And I invite you to do the same. You'll never regret investing in another leader who makes a positive difference in this world. It's the best way to extend your influence and achieve significance. I'm so glad I had an opportunity to read this chapter to you because it's very important to me that you make that shift. And the reason why is because that shift really has changed my life, perhaps more than any of those that I have taught you so far. My friend Tyler Perry has written a book called Higher is Waiting. It's a wonderful, devotional, inspirational book. He talks in one chapter about how do the mother eagles get the young eaglets to leave that comfortable, secure nest and fly. Because the mother eagles, as these little babies are growing, come to that nest, and it's roomy and it's comfortable, and they feed them in there, and that's where all their security would lie. But as it comes time for them to begin to fly, the mother realizes this much sooner than the babies. They want to stay in that secure nest and let mama feed them some more. So what does she do to get them out of the nest? Very simply, She flies around the nest with the food, but she doesn't bring the food into the nest. Those little eaglets want that food so bad. They're right on the edge of that nest, and they're kind of jumping up for it. And before they know it, they jump out of the nest to get the food. And that's how they are fed. Now the mother eagle, right there in case there's a little bit of a flying problem to kind of help pick them up. But what is incredibly beautiful about this story is that the mother realizes, usually before the eaglet, that it's time for them to fly. When I think of ladder building, I think a lot of times, because we get attached to the people that we love and that we mentor, we have a tendency for us to kind of hold their ladder or maybe extend their ladder. But that last step of letting them go over and build their own ladder and cheering them on, that's the tough step, because they're now leaving the nest. They're now going to go out on their own. And there's something about a little bit of difficulty as a leader to just kind of let that person go. We still love and want a piece of that. I just want you to know that you need to let your people fly. You need to help them reach their God-given potential. And what I've discovered is this. The greatest way to do that is to get into the ladder building business. So after you have held the ladder and extended the ladder, it's time for them to kind of be kicked out of the nest. And you're going to recognize it probably before they do. It's okay. It's a good thing. Put your arm around them and say, okay, it's time for you to build your ladder and climb to the calling and the destiny that God has given to you. I challenge you, when you start ladder building and see all the people climbing and doing the work that you equip them to do, it will be your greatest reward. Ladder climbing, it's a good thing. Ladder building, oh my goodness, that's a great thing. Chapter 8, Directing to Connecting, The Communication Shift. Dwight D. Eisenhower said, "You don't lead by hitting people over the head. That's assault, not leadership." All of the leaderships in my life have not occurred in the same way or on the same timetable. Some have occurred gradually, while others were almost instantaneous. Many were prompted by my leadership intuition, which has often been the catalyst for the changes that I've made. But some, like the communication shift from directing to connecting, went against my natural grain. This was a shift in the opposite direction of my experience, and it required time to develop. I grew up in a home where directing was the practiced style of communication and leadership. In our family culture, everyone had assignments. We each had chores to do and times to do them, and my father was always certain to explain why we were required to do everything that we did. My parents provided clarity, purpose, and a schedule. My brother, sister, and I were expected to understand and obey their direction with promptness. My college theological training in communication and leadership reinforced this directing mythology. In communication, we were taught to preach with boldness and passion. My style had both of these qualities in abundance. Plus, when I preached, I also added application, which is another way of giving direction. I worked to make every message I preached practical and to always provide a game plan to the people I was addressing. I felt good if at the end of the service, everyone left with something to do that week. In leadership, the authority in our ecclesiastical world was top-down. The Constitution and bylaws of the organization stated that as the pastor, I was chairman of the board, and the governing rules made it clear that everything was supposed to begin with me. The agenda, the church's leadership, and spiritual authority. People in my role were given the position of leadership in the boardrooms, and if they didn't make it clear enough that they were supposed to be the leader of the pack, then they would use the sermon to reinforce the idea. And I have to admit, I was guilty of that too. I may not have been Moses coming down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments to give to the people, but upon occasion, I acted like Moses Jr. So I came from an upbringing and training that emphasized directing. On top of all of this, my temperament is choleric, which means I love to be in charge and tell others what to do. I'm bossy. I know where I want to go, and I'm not shy about saying how we should get there. If you have a question, I've got an answer. If you're not sure what you want to do, I can give you a plan for your life. Directing others was a very natural leadership style for me. But what's natural for me is not necessarily what's best for others. Nobody wants to be bossed around. Many times I could sense that people were following me only because they had to, not because they wanted to. Even those who wanted to follow me didn't always buy into the vision and direction I was communicating as strongly as I had hoped. Intuitively, I began to understand that I needed to move away from directing. I no longer wanted to be a leadership cop, standing at the intersection of my organization and directing traffic all the time. But at the same time, I didn't know what else to do. What better way was there to lead people? Welcome to a new paradigm. Two experiences functioned as catalysts to help me reshape my communication and leadership style. The first occurred in 1988. That was the year I hired Bob Beale as a consultant. At that time, I was leading a large, high-profile church, and my influence was growing nationally and even internationally. I was getting a tremendous number of requests to speak to other organizations and to help them by providing resources. My sense was that I needed to create an organization to handle these requests, and I wanted it to pay for itself, not make it a nonprofit. But back then, I had no personal experience in the business world, so I asked Bob to answer questions and give me some needed direction. This was my first experience hiring a business consultant, and it was before I had developed much experience as a ladder builder, so the way Bob started the process took me totally by surprise. We spent 2 days together, and the entire first day, Bob asked me questions. The entire day! He'd ask a question I'd answer, and he'd ask follow-up questions based on my answers. He worked with flip charts, writing the questions and the answers, and at the end of the day, every wall in my office was covered with sheets of paper containing everything that we had talked about. I was exhausted, but I was fulfilled. In those hours, Bob had drawn out of me my innermost thoughts, hopes, and aspirations in a way that never had been done before. With each question, he had peeled away another layer, revealing the depth of my thinking and feelings. It was exhilarating. I learned an important lesson that day. Bob had to find me, who I was, where I had been, where I hoped to go, before he could lead me. That opened my eyes to a better way of leading, and the discovery became the foundation of my practice of connecting with others. From then on, I started working to find people by asking questions before trying to lead them. The second experience that impacted me greatly occurred in 2003. I was invited to attend a basketball game at the University of Tennessee Lady Volunteers, coached by the great Pat Summitt. I attended their pregame and sat right behind the bench. At halftime, I was able to go into the locker room and observe how Pat coached the team. When we got to the locker room, Pat and the other coaches huddled together away from the players, while the players immediately sat in a semicircle around a whiteboard that had three questions written on it. One, what did we do right in the first half? Two, what did we do wrong? Three, what do we need to change? For 5 minutes, the players discussed their answers to those three questions, while one player wrote down their responses. I sat behind the players and I watched. I was fascinated. Then Pat walked over to the marker board and looked at the answers. She made a couple of comments related to what they had written and then sent the players back out on the floor to warm up for the second half. After the game, I asked Pat about it, and her answer was stunning. "John, too many leaders lead by assumption," she said. "They assume. They know where their people are. That halftime exercise lets me find my players so I can lead them. That can only be done by asking questions and listening to their answers." That was a huge aha moment for me, and was the second bookend to my leader shift from directing to connecting. I was determined from that moment forward to use connecting as the basis for my leadership and communication style. So let's take a look for a moment. Let's see the contrast between these two styles. Well, directing includes being authoritative, talking. It's very top-down. It's about enlisting, assuming, giving answers, and it's pretty much about, this is my agenda, follow me. Where connecting, it includes being collaborative, listening, coming side by side that person, empowering, understanding, asking more questions, and it's all about the other person's agenda. The goal of connecting is to find common ground with the leader initiating. This is a place where both people meet. Both people are valued. Both people share. Both people listen and learn. Both people adjust. Both people settle on a game plan. Both people take ownership of the game plan, and both people move together to higher ground. Learning to connect is one of the most important things you can ever do in life. In my book, Winning with People, I assert that people can usually trace their successes and their failures to the relationships they've had in their life. This is especially evident in leadership. Make the leadership shift to connecting. If you want to become the best leader you're capable of being, you must learn to connect with people. To do that, you must find ways to overcome the challenges of connecting and finding common ground. This can often be a difficult process, especially with a varied team. Here are 7 things I have found to be most important to a leader who wants to connect with others. Number 1, humility. Let people know you need them. I had the privilege of meeting one of my heroes, John Wooden, and being mentored by him during his latter years. Back in 2001, I came across a piece written about him by Michael Josephson, president and founder of the Josephson Institute of Ethics. I can't recall where I found it, but I love it. Coach was a great connector, and I think Josephson's piece gives wonderful insight about him. One of my personal heroes turned 91. He's not a general or a politician or a movie star. He's a teacher. Oh, I admit, he's not an ordinary teacher. He also's the world's most successful and famous basketball coach. But John Wooden is, above all, a teacher. Even more, he's a homespun philosopher. His thoughts and theories have been recorded in dozens of books, but reading John Wooden doesn't hold a candle to hearing from the man himself. The power of his words is amplified by his extraordinary character. You don't just meet the coach, you experience him. The man exudes an inner dignity and moral strength that makes you feel both worthy and humble at the same time. When he tells you what he knows, you believe it's all because he cares about you and hopes it will be helpful. Integrity, respect, and kindness pervade everything he says. But more striking, it seems so effortless. He has received more awards and accolades than any 10 of his peers, yet he is genuinely humble. I had to insist that he would call me by his first name so he'd stop calling me Mr. Josephson. He talks about issues of honor, hard work, preparation, and self-discipline as if there were no other choices. This both inspires and humbles me. You see, for me, trying to be a person of character involves a daily struggle. Sometimes it feels as if I'm acting the part of a good person rather than really being one. I don't think I will ever be as gracefully authentic as Coach Wooden. Yet, if I told him this, I think he would smile and say something like, "Michael, never underestimate what you can do. Why don't you keep trying? You'll get better." Those words echo how I felt when I was with Coach. No man in my life helped me more or connected with me better than he did. The core of that connection was his humility. John Wooden, knew his strengths, and used them to help others. He was not preoccupied with himself,